SCR 58 and open a concurrent public hearing on HCR 55 and 60. And Mr. Moore, would you please give us a rundown on HCR 55 and 60, please?
Mr. Chair and committee members, HCR 55 refers to the people and amendments to the Oregon Constitution to establish a state stabilization fund. Growth is limited to 5% of the general fund, such as stems in which economic conditions or emergency must exist to utilize the fund. This is a fund includes Oregon State Lottery Fund allocation, the Master Settlement Fund under the Master Settlement Agreement of 1998, donations, and monies appropriated by the Legislative Assembly. Earnings from the fund are to be retained in the fund, establish 3/5 supermajority votes to appropriate the fund. HCR 55 will allocate 60% of the stabilization fund to public education, 20% of the fund will be used towards public health, and 20% towards public safety. Use of the fund in each of these instances will be triggered by specific economic downturns outlined in the bill. The tobacco settlement money was seen as the resource to adequately fund this proposal. Also included in your packets, statement for Dan Bunn, who was unable to make it here, and I think he has a representative here.
All right, do you have a sign of sheet for these two bills?
Regarding HCR 60, the first the people and members of the Oregon Constitution to establish an economic stabilization fund, and in the similar terms as the previous bill. Budget stabilization funds or rainy day funds are, as they often are called, are common now in most states. By early 1995, 45 states and Puerto Rico had created a total of 51 funds. The only jurisdictions without such funds are Arkansas, the District of Columbia, Hawaii, Illinois, Montana, and Oregon. The original concept of the budget stabilization fund is straightforward. Money is saved when state finances are healthy or when the state economy takes a downturn. Over time, however, this definition of stabilization fund has been extended to encompass other budgetary concerns.
Thank you very much, Mr. Moore. We do have the chief sponsors of HCR 60 on our committee. I'd like to give you, Representative Williams and Representative Edwards, an opportunity to speak on your bill, should you desire to do so. That's fine. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to testify on this bill. As the legislative session was getting underway early in January, Representative Edwards and I had numerous conversations about what we believe is a need for an economic stabilization fund in Oregon. I think that the evidence from some of the interim work that went on regarding taxation in Oregon, I think, was fairly clear evidence to me that as one of only five states in the country without an economic stabilization fund, Oregon faces a very difficult challenge if at some point in the future this wonderful period of economic growth we have slows down. And if the chairman will allow me, without the numbers directly in front of me, to just comment that I believe that even an economic growth rate dropping to 4% will put us somewhere between $500 to $700 million shortfall in our general fund budget. My personal belief about an economic stabilization fund and our need for it, Mr. Chairman, is to allow the state of Oregon, if faced with such an economic downturn, to essentially ramp down our state expenditures in a reasonable manner by being able to turn to that sort of a fund to make up some of those short-term shortfalls as we adjust spending, clearly which would probably occur in some sort of a special session of the legislature if we weren't meeting otherwise. And I guess, Mr. Chairman, I try to read sometimes about what those who have gone before us did. And in this book that all of you, I think, received a copy of, Legislative Perspectives, I was reading about the 1943 legislative session and came across what I thought was an interesting entry that I would share with you. First, it talks about the divisive issues of that session. There were state budget surpluses and what to do with them. Some wanted to pay off existing debts, others urged reductions, and still others urged the creation of a permanent and substantial emergency reserve fund. I think that this issue is one that has been around, and as you and I have talked, Mr. Chairman, there are very few new ideas in this body. We simply reupholster ones that have been before us. This may be just that, but I would seriously encourage this committee and this legislature as a whole to have a very thoughtful discussion about what happens to our state budget in that time that surely will come when our economy will slow and we will be faced with these very, very difficult choices. As my father used to say, pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered. It's time, I think, that we as legislators recognize that we ought to be thinking about being pigs and not hogs.
Such a graphic description. Thank you very much. I appreciate this. This is a historical perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Representative from House District 15 in Portland. It's kind of hard to follow on the pigs and slaughter analogy, but I do think there is actually a we do need to be looking at this in a very serious way this session. I think there's been many indications. The governor had a task force that recommended that we needed to do something, and that was a recommendation from a group of folks outside of the building who are business-minded largely, who came to the same conclusion that the state needs some sort of reserve fund, not if, but when we do have a downturn. And as staff prescribed, most states have some policy in place whereby they put money aside. I think if we would all be mindful of just as an individual, putting money aside is always an important thing to do because there will be a time when you're not as flush as you are today. How we do that has always been a question, and finding new revenue, perhaps, or using additional revenue has always been a difficult task. As Representative Williams described, we collaborated early on in the session. We talked about perhaps the tobacco settlement money was one source, again, that could be used for this. The treasurer of Oregon just stepped out with a plan. I'm not suggesting any one way of going about this other than we do think this type of discussion and vehicle could be very useful long-term for the state. I think the question for us is politically, do we have the will to put something forward? And I think it always hinges on how do you put money in it, and then you can discuss about the uses. But I think the first step is, do we need one? I think the answer is resoundingly yes. Then the next step is, how do you begin to fund that plan? And what we put together was a constitutional measure. You could argue whether you need to put it in the Constitution. We felt that that would be a good, strong signal to the taxpayers of the state that that was a reasonable way to assure the security of the funds. Now it would be used in a respected way, and then we do talk about how when a quote we need that fund or grains, as you've heard in this building, that there would be limitations to that. We also built in there a way in which the trust fund, as it fills up with economic stabilization fund, the interest on it can be used for housing purposes, and that's something we've been discussing relative to House Bill 2007. I think you'll hear from at least one other person this afternoon, we'll discuss the housing need, and I think, again, using the interest earned off this fund is a prudent way to help a very needed policy in the state. Again, I personally, Max and I got together early on in session, put this together. Things have changed, perhaps, but I think the principles are still there and the need is still there. So I think if there's anything from my perspective is we as committee should look at seriously how do we put something, craft something together that long-term addresses the shortfall that is inevitable at some point. At some point, we're going to have the economy take a slowdown, and we're going to need some backstop in that situation. I'm happy to answer the questions you have.
I would just echo what Representative Edwards said, Mr. Chairman, that I you know, the politics and the political realities of this proposal have changed as the contours of the discussion about what to do with the tobacco settlement money have also changed. This proposal was prepared well in advance of leadership's proposal under 2007 for the health security trust fund. But I would agree with Representative Edwards that we will be failing Oregonians, I believe, by failing to address a fiscal stabilization fund issue this session. We have cruised along with a very strong economy that gives us $1.2 billion in additional revenue to spend this session that we didn't have last time. Those good times that have been such a part of the last several years of this state will not go on indefinitely, and we will be very imprudent, I think, by not doing something to protect ourselves for the time when those good times will end. So I would agree with Representative Edwards, and I hope that this begins just as a framework for discussion, and that we can have a serious discussion about this proposal. I'm certainly open to any suggestions that committee members would have about how we might fund this. Obviously, we're about the furthest committee from funding that you can get, Mr. Chairman, so once we have those great ideas, I'm not sure what we'll do with them, but we'll leave that, obviously, to your able hands.
Well, thank you for your confidence, Senator Williams. I know that we did have a slump in Oregon's economy in the mid-80s, and those who were serving at that time were called into repeated special sessions of the legislature to find more funds and cut programs, and that's how we got ourselves into the safe problem. We are just now beginning to
raise taxes
and just now beginning to pay off the money that was taken from states, the state accident insurance fund. So. I do think it's appropriate to have the discussion, and would open up to any questions from members of the committee regarding HCR 60. Sounds like you sold everybody.
Good. You pass. You going to make the motion, Representative, sir?
It didn't work.
This is an amateur job, right?
I want to announce to the audience that we do have hearing devices available. Do you have one with you? Would you hold one of them up, please? They're a battery-operated. The discussion in the committee room is broadcast on the. These little receivers pick it up. So as soon as we finish these two bills, we'll get on down to House Bill 3400 and get relates to hearing impaired and providing devices that help the hearing impaired. Close casting. Peter Grunfoss. And Mr. Wells, would you please call Representative Stobeck's office and see if he would like to come down and testify and instruct the fire? Mr. Grunfoss.
Mr. Chairman and committee, thank you for the opportunity of testifying on HJR 60 this afternoon. Appreciate it. I'm having written testimony distributed to you. I'm going to try to shorten it as much as possible, and I'm especially pleased that Representative Starr is here today, because Representative Starr has put himself in a position by his committee assignments this session to just about memorize major portions of my testimony by now, or at the end of today's session. I want to speak in stronger terms for HJR 60 than Representative Williams and Representative Edwards did of their own bill. I agree with them that it is more a vehicle for the discussion of the stabilization fund and a method for funding housing than it is the last word. I don't think it's the final answer on the issue, but it is a tremendous vehicle for focusing on our subject. They've described what it does briefly, and I won't spend too much more time on that. Basically, it provides that the money from the tobacco master settlement 1998, to which Oregon is a party, would flow into an economic stabilization fund, number one, until the fund reaches 5% of the appropriations budget in any given year. And the interest from that fund would flow off and go to low-income affordable housing. Of course, I'm here today speaking for the Association of Oregon Housing Authorities and the Housing Lobby Coalition. The Housing Lobby Coalition is comprised of 35 housing lobbyists that have worked together closely since 1990, trying to find ways to fund low-income affordable housing, and this is a good way to do it. This addresses two major issues, the stabilization fund and housing, but we need to go beyond that. That is to say, I think that the state treasurer's plan ought to be given a close look by the legislature. The state treasurer's plan is similar to this insofar as it would establish a stabilization fund and then use some of the proceeds from the tobacco settlement money for other purposes. The treasurer's plan would get to three issues, not only the stabilization fund, but it would also provide a way to capitalize or provide capital for the public schools, and it would provide a health fund. If you added to the treasurer's plan the concept of using the interest on the stabilization fund for low-income affordable housing, then you'd have a complete package. And this is extremely important because we've got a desperate housing situation. We've had an ongoing housing crisis now for 10 years. 107,000 households earn 50% or less the median income and pay 30% or more of that income for rent and utilities. Another 6,000 people seek emergency shelter every night, and 2,000 of those are children. Oregon needs 60,000 additional units of housing affordable to people who earn 50% or less of median income. That is the bottom 25% of the economy. The state has done precious little to dampen the flames of the housing crisis in the past decade, even though that crisis has been well documented. The legislature started the decade in 1991 with high hopes and much fanfare, with a $20 million appropriation for low-income housing development. Affordable housing advocates hope to see that level of attack on the problem continue throughout the decade and on into the future. Instead, in 1993, the appropriation dropped from $20 million to $6.5 million, and in 1995 and 1997, the appropriations were less than $5 million in each biennium. I've passed out, in addition to my verbal testimony, I've passed out a copy of a history of funding of state housing programs, and you can take a look at that, and you'll look at the 1991-93 column and go across and look at the 1997-99 column, and you'll see that in virtually every line, we've been flatlined, or housing appropriations have actually declined during this period of time, in spite of the fact that the low-income population has increased, the number of people that need this kind of help have increased, and inflation has increased, and housing costs have vastly outstripped the wages of the working class, the lower 25% of the economy. So we haven't done very well since 1991 and need to step it up. HCR 50 would work just, by the way, the Housing Lobby Coalition has a bill in the hopper. It's before the legislature now. It's SB 939 that does what HJR 60 does, or would do. It establishes an economic stabilization account, the interest from which would be used for low-income affordable housing. However, HJR 60 would work just fine. state treasurer believes that tobacco money will flow into the state at the rate of about $98 million per year for at least 20 years. In order to illustrate what this bill, H.J.R. 60, would do, let me point out that 6% interest on $100 million is $6 million. So each $98 million annual increment would produce an additional $6 million or so as follows, and you've got the chart in front of you. Shows the flow of money into the stabilization fund and the interest that would develop in years 1 through 10. We're also told by the Attorney General's office that the first payment into the fund will probably happen sometime in the year 2000, no later than June 30th, 2000. That was his testimony before this committee earlier in the session. It looks as though the stabilization fund would be capped at 5% of appropriations in the seventh or eighth year of tobacco settlement collections. And, of course, under H.J.R. 60, then you're free to do with the money whatever you want. Today, the State Department of Housing and Community Services couldn't spend $42 million a year on the problems I have described, but in a few years, it could do so easily. The ramp up here to year 7, I believe, is doable for the department. This committee needs to discuss details with DHCS because the money can be used in a number of productive programs. I should note that because the tobacco settlement payments don't start until mid-2000 and then at low levels, we would need to bridge financing until the payments ramp up sufficiently. But what about other state needs? Well, that's where the state treasurer's plan comes in. And I think that the discussions over that plan need to be folded in with discussions about H.J.R. 60 because H.J.R. 60 addresses the housing needs. And if the treasurer's plan did give interest to housing, which it does not now, I would say it would be a better plan than H.J.R. 60 because it would help housing, education, and health, and it would get us out of the Capitol by July 4th. Mr. Chairman and committee, these are complex matters that need more time for discussion by a lot of interested parties, but I believe that H.J.R. 60 and the Treasurer's Plan lay the groundwork for solutions to several funding problems which I've described, and they ought to be addressed. There's one other thing I want to say, and it appears in my written testimony up near the top. That is to say that when we came here, the Association of Oregon Housing Authorities agreed that tobacco settlement money ought to be used first and foremost for the prevention and cure of health problems related to tobacco consumption. And we still believe that. But to the extent that there is excess, or to the extent that this legislature is going to discuss using the money for other purposes, then we think housing ought to clearly be considered, because housing is absolutely fundamental to health. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be glad to answer questions if there are any.
Any questions, Mr. Grunfossen?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Starr.
I just want to thank Mr. Grunfossen for his tireless advocacy on this issue, and I appreciate the times that he's appeared before committees that I've sat on, and I appreciate the information he's provided us today.
Thank you, Mr. Grunfossen.
Thank you.
I'll call Greg McMurdo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. For your record, Greg McMurdo from the Department of Education. I'm here for Superintendent Dunn, who could not be with us, who had a conflict in his schedule. I'd like to thank the previous witnesses. They've done most of my work for me, and I would only say substitute perhaps education for housing, because that's certainly the emphasis in H.J.R. 55. I would just like to set forth for the committee some of the principles we think are very important that must be considered in any state stabilization fund. We believe it needs to be a constitutional fund to protect the integrity of the fund from future legislative action. And in particular, we believe that the sources ought to be in that fund, and in H.J.R. 55 there are several sources enumerated. The two obviously of significance are the tobacco settlement funds and the increased lottery receipts beginning in the year 2001. We also believe that the allocation, whatever allocation we decide on, also should be set in the Constitution. H.R. 55 would establish 60% for education with 20% for health and 20% for public safety. We also believe that the triggering of the allocations from the fund needs to be in the Constitution. In this case, it would be a recession and a projection of a negative ending balance for the biennium, or an emergency as determined by a three-fifths vote of members of the Legislative Assembly. And finally, there is one other provision we believe should be in any stabilization fund, and that is a prohibition against disproportionate allotments by future legislative sessions, so that any amounts flowing from the stabilization fund would not be offset by an overall allotment that is different from the allotments generally given the state government when there is a downturn. I realize you've got a lot of competing interests here, but it's the superintendent's belief that your primary interest or concern ought to be education, at least with respect to 60% of this fund. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be pleased to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. McMurdo from the committee? Thank you, Mr. McMurdo, for coming today. Raleigh Wisbrock. Hello, Raleigh.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Raleigh Wisbrock. I'm Chief of Staff for Oregon Treasury. I'm honored to be here today to discuss this bill. This is an idea that the Treasurer has been interested in for as long as he has been Treasurer. I really appreciate the comments from all of the other speakers on both bills. I think they point very clearly to the need to establish a budget stabilization fund. We think the tenets of both HR 60 and HR 55 are very important to proceed on. Let me give you just a little bit of background why we're doing what we're doing relevant to this bill. Gee, for the past 7 years, this economy has been the strongest in the history of the state. Not one of the strongest economies, but in fact, the historically the strongest economy in the history of the state of Oregon. And it's unfortunate in these very, very healthy economic times that we have not been able to put aside funds to protect us in the future in any economic downturn. There's the old saw about the ant and the grasshopper, and the grasshopper fiddles and the ant puts away, and this perhaps is time for us to consider that little bit of folksy guidance, and it's a time to do that. We discussed Senate Bill 190 as a possibility for a budget stabilization fund that would provide the economic security for Oregon that we think would carry us through those down times, or at least be able to mitigate the down times. We broadened our discussion on Senate Bill 190 to include the governor and superintendent of schools, Stan Bunn. Both showed a strong interest in the concept of budget stabilization. They have been engaged, as we had in the discussion, over the past 6 years. We were able to compromise on what is before you as House Joint Resolution 55. I think what got us to the table together was our common understanding that what we needed to protect were the core services of the state of Oregon, that we needed to protect education in an economic downturn, we needed to protect public safety, and we certainly needed to protect health in the state. And what we tried to provide in that discussion, as Greg has identified, is 60% cap for education, 20% for the other two remaining areas. And we think that's very important. Those core services are truly critical to us. And I have a transition in a second into one of our major concerns is the bond rating, but that is one of the key issues that the bond rating agencies have when we have our discussion, is that not just one sector is protected, but basically you protected the core of services within a state. Treasurer Hill suggested a program that was discussed a few minutes ago about how we could fund the Budget Stabilization Fund. I really think that it offers an opportunity to put some of that money to work, not only to protect the health interests that I know the chair is concerned with,
and protect education, but also to protect the future of all of the services in the state of Oregon in case of economic downturn. Let me just take a quick aside. When the governor's task force on taxation presented to the Ways and Means Committee, what seems like years ago, but at the beginning of this session, the committee asked, they made a recommendation that a budget stabilization fund was critical to the state. It was one of the most important recommendations that a budget stabilization fund be developed. The chief economist for U.S. Bank, John Mitchell, I think many of you know him, and is one of the leading economic financial minds in the Northwest, discussed what the stabilization fund would mean and when it potentially could be implemented. And he crafted it in this way, and I really want to draw on that just for a second. He suggested that the stabilization fund would not necessarily just be needed in times of economic crisis, that we could see the kind of shortfalls in revenue in this state if we just had a slight cooling of our economy, not a decline, but a slow leveling off of the rate of growth. And he's saying that would, you know, and we're going to need it. And he moved a step further, and some of this was mentioned in my testimony, and he said the reason why a slowdown in the economy could put us in a position of revenue shortfall is because of the new tax system that have established in the state of Oregon. In the early 90s, as you all know, we made a transition through ballot measures 5 and 50 to income tax, both corporate and personal, as the primary source of revenue for all programs in the state of Oregon. Historically, we had two legs of a stool that had paper taxes. And one was property tax, which primarily supported schools, and then we had income tax, which supported personal and corporate income tax, which supported other state services. As Chief Economist Mitchell pointed out, what we had seen in the early 90s was a revolution in the tax structure of the state, a revolution that had never been tested in a down economy. He categorized the income tax as volatile. We do too. We believe that he is right on target. That the income tax is volatile, that it goes up, it expands quickly. And we have seen that over the past 7 years. We have seen our ending balances very strong in the state. We said it's going to go down just as fast, and it's not going to take a recession to trigger that shortfall. They said it's just going to take a cooling to trigger the shortfall because the income tax is so extraordinarily sensitive to any fluctuations in the market. He was very clear in pointing out that the property tax that we had before was not sensitive to those ups and downs. It was much less sensitive to those ups and downs. So what we have to consider now is that we have a new system that we have to guide ourselves under that is going to be volatile and sensitive to any movement, and that what we don't have is a structure to handle the downside of that movement, to handle the shortfalls that we'll get in even a cooling economy that could stimulate the kind of environment that you had in the recession of 1981 or the early 80s. That recession, as the chair has pointed out, brought this chamber back into special session, I think about 7 times, had a massive shortfall. I think you had, at the end of 1981, the ending balance was about $25 million when you all left, when the legislature left. Within 6 months, the shortfall hit. With 18 months, the shortfall was $253 million, if I recall off the top of my head, give or take a few hundred dollars. That's massive. What happened, as the chair pointed out, is that there was a rate on credit, that $81 million, which eventually cost the state $234 million in payments. Also understand that that's when the state picked up the individual's contribution on the first payment. Understand that taxes were raised for 3 years and services were cut. What a horrible position for legislators to be in, to have to cut services and raise taxes at the same time, services that are really needed in a time of economic downturn. Excuse me. HR 55 defines an economic downturn. In compromising with the governor's office and with Superintendent Bunn and trying to address some of the concerns that we knew that this body would have when we crafted HR 55, we knew that the legislature was concerned about creating a fund that would be used as a slush fund. And we tried to craft into HJR 55 a prohibition on that, or constraints against being able to use this as a slush fund. We defined an economic downturn was as a recession, as a decline in revenues that is significant. It's defined. It's very clearly defined. We also, though, wanted to make sure that it was not just an economic downturn of significance that would trigger the ability to use the money. That it was a concern of ours, and in discussion with the rating agencies, it's a concern of theirs that if we have another type of economic crisis, that would not just be a revenue shortfall, that we'd be able to touch the money. And we knew that this is where the legislature perhaps would have the greatest concern. Again, you don't want to create a slush fund, and what we built into the bill was a prohibition for using any of the funds for new programs or backfilling budgets. We understood clearly that is something that you did not want to have happen. We put that language in there, but we also required a three-fifths vote of this body. And you all know how difficult a three-fifths vote on the floor of both houses is going to be if we ever have to draw on the money. It's a very high bar. We wanted that high bar to give the legislature confidence. We wanted that high bar to give the people who will vote on this high confidence. Let me take another aside. We've crafted this bill as a House joint resolution to go to the people as a constitutional amendment. It could also be drafted as a statutory regulation also, if you choose to do so. We tried to build the protections in, so would and again, not be considered or perceived as a slush fund or even passed. We don't think it will be. We certainly don't suggest that this bill will create an armor that will recession-proof the state of Oregon from an economic downturn or an economic emergency. It won't do that. But understanding where economist John Mitchell came from in saying that what we will see in the future in the state because of basically the one-tax system is this kind of fluctuation over a very short time frame, and we had not seen that before because of how we had structured our taxes in the past. We're not going back there. We understand that. So how do we make the best of the structure that we have before us today? We wanted to make sure that the legislature had the ability to withstand those fluctuations without having to do the things that the legislature had to do in 1981, without having to raise taxes. Nobody wants to do that. Without having to cut services, in an irresponsible manner. Nobody wanted to do that then either. We wanted to give the legislature some tools to be able to withstand the fluctuations so that you can make reasoned judgments in good policy. And we think this is certainly a good tool. Let me speak to what other states are doing relevant to budget stabilization. In the testimony on House Joint Resolution 60 that was given before us, Representative Williams pointed out, or it was in the pre-testimony, that only a few states do not have a budget stabilization fund. Five, in fact, that were identified. Illinois, by the way, has begun legislation to develop its own budget stabilization fund and are doing so, I understand, very aggressively. We are rated lower. There are no states in the remaining five that don't have a budget stabilization fund that are rated higher than us. And I'm going to go on some back. I will share with you some communication that we've had with the bond rating agencies. Very candidly asked them, what is it going to take to move the state of Oregon into a double A plus rating that will save the state tens of millions of dollars in lower interest rates as we purchase bonds in the future? They're very clear that we have two things that they're concerned with. One is the initiative system that we have, and two is the fact that we don't have a budget stabilization fund. And they link the two. Also, they clearly understand that nobody is going to stand up and say, take away the initiative system. The initiative system is part of who we are as a state. We all understand that it's going to stay there. It may be modified in different ways. It's never going to go away. It's part of who we are. They said, and they understood that. They said, but what you don't have is a stabilization fund that allows you, under your new tax structure, to be able to respond to any new pressure that may be put on the state budget. You can't, and you also don't have the ability to withstand the economic downturn. They are very concerned with that. The bond rating agencies are concerned with that. It is a critical issue to the Treasurer. This is our initial impetus to try to do something with House Joint Resolution 55. And we feel that if we are to get a bond rating upgrade, we must have a budget stabilization fund. Not necessarily this exact fund that we think is very good, but we need a budget stabilization fund. We've talked to the agencies about that. They understand what we're presenting to you, and they are strongly supportive of this. They have made it clear behind closed doors that we may never get a rating increase unless we have this. And this in itself will not guarantee it, but it guarantees without having it that we will not get the rating increase.
Well, yes. How are other states with you? I know here in the written testimony that the Oregon is currently rated AA. Give me some examples of some states who do have a budget stabilization fund and what their bond ratings are.
I can provide a complete list to the committee. I could probably give you some off the top of my head, but I would prefer to give you a complete list. We have that information available. We've looked at every state, and I believe no, it's not in. I will write it to you. It's available to us. I'll provide it to you.
Another question I have for you is, what would be the interest in real dollars to Oregon? What would be the net gain to Oregon if we had a AAA rating versus a AA rating?
We had a AAA rating in the early 80s prior to recession, and then the problems combined with that we had was that we had a AAA rating. This was the best program, and that really, I think, dropped us down to the AA minus rating. We did some calculations on that, and this is a staggering number, but for the debt that we were issuing and running that for the life of the debt that we were issuing, you know, under that rating, it was about $350 to $400 million additional cost for the debt that we issued. He spread that over a 30-year period, or 30-year period, is what we amortized. It's a massive number. It was a massive number. California, when they, I can't give you exact figures, when California dropped their rating from a AAA and just went into the tank, it was considered that that would have cost them billions of dollars in increased interest. So it's a significant number, and all I can tell you is it was calculated not by us, but by Tony Meeker when he was here, because he sat here then. It was just a devastating figure, and we used that figure, and I've asked our bond people if they still live by that figure, and they say absolutely.
Can you get us something about that in writing?
I will provide both of those to you in writing.
Thank you very much.
One last point. There was an editorial problem with HDR 55 when it was drafted, and it was inadvertently talked to both all the parties involved with the negotiations on this, Superintendent Bunn's office and the governor's office. On page 2, lines 20 through 25, basically sets out that we'll only use the interest off of the fund, and that's not what it's intended to be. What we're trying to do with the fund is to create a fund representing about 5% of the general fund and lottery revenues. That whole fund could be used to address any downturn or crisis, not just the interest. Let me show you what the interest would be. And because a fund like that has to be invested short-term, it cannot be invested in equities. It has to be invested either in cash or very short-term notes, because an emergency is going to come and you need to be able to draw on it. You understand the business reasoning for that. That means you're getting about 5% interest, 5% on $500 million about $25 million. It's not enough to take care of the hiccups, so that was inadvertent. None of the parties intended that. It was the way it was initially drafted, and it was a drafting error on our part. And that would be the only modification that we'd make. As we discussed, the interest would flow back to the general fund. We understand that HR 60 would use the interest for housing. That's certainly your call. It was of substance to do, either one of those. And it doesn't damage all what we were talking about.
All righty. Thank you.
Yep,
any questions? Yes, Representative Beck?
I have a question.
following up on some of your questions, Mr. Chair, I was really struck by this drop in bond rating, or maybe I'm more struck by the number of states who've increased their bond rating this decade.
Yes.
Let me get to it on page 3 here. Let's say, today, 47% of general fund obligations, the 47 states with general funds,
47% of general fund obligations have increased.
47 by that percentage. That's different.
Well, and it's different than 47, but I understand the numbers are massive.
But what, I guess what I'd like to get from you is how many states have went from AA to AAA in the last 5 to 10 years. If you can get, when you can,
I can
that for it.
I can do that.
I'm curious to see that. The other question is I have, and just maybe you off the top of your head, is what are total, if we had put all of our kickers into a fund, stabilization fund, since 87, whenever the kickers started ticking, I don't know which year after recession that started, but I'd be curious to get, just for my own general interest, if we hadn't returned the kicker, if we hadn't sent the kicker, what the total accumulation of kickers would be since it started kicking. Maybe you know that.
I know that off the top of my head. I don't know why I know that. At $1.9 billion.
So we have almost $2 billion in a stabilization fund, and we just stuck it away. Fascinating. Well, Mr. Chair, this is, I've seen some very troubling constitutional amendments running through the building. This one strikes me as one I hope we take. This is important, unlike some other things that I've seen floating around that are moving through committees. And I hope we'll take a serious look. And if we do, I hope we'll spend the time working this measure out so that it really meets the needs of the agencies, the governor, and your office, and so we really have a good bill to send out to the voters. I think this makes a lot of sense. I'm all for pushing you to push us to work on it.
Well, consider yourself pushed if you're in
the job. All right.
Further questions? President Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the testimony, Polly. And maybe at some point, Mr. Chair, if we go down the path of actually really trying to craft some bill or measure to send out to the voters, I would like to hear from the Treasurer's Office their plan. I've seen a draft of what you put out a few days ago. You do have a stabilization fund concept in there. If I recall, you put in $200 million to the health fund that we, I guess, is in Jason Murder 2007. And maybe there's some discussion about how best to construct a bill that addresses the issues outlined in 2007, the need for some stabilization fund, and then how we fund it. And I think, again, this is the tobacco money that has supported us. Obviously, this session, it wasn't there last session, and our discussion last session was whether to use the kicker money or not. Politically, that was a little tougher sell, but I'd suggest that we've got a unique opportunity now to set up something that could be funded through some money that were never anticipated, or at least hadn't been until this session. So I would like to hear at some point some presentation by the Treasurer's Office, kind of their concept and how their stabilization fund, if it's different from HDR 55, what you envision with that. And because, again, I echo Representative Beck's concern, which is, we've got to act at some point. And this, whether it's constitutional or statutory, I think that's a policy question we can argue. But I think the fact of the matter, in the cases being laid out by the Treasurer's Office, that we as a state need to act fiscally responsible and have some reserve fund set up, whatever stripe you want to call it, in addition to the health fund, that would afford us as legislators to meet that downturn or anticipated downturn. I guess that was an interesting slice on whether or not it actually had to be a specific as the economist Mitchell was suggesting, that it doesn't necessarily have to be in a recession. It could be just the beginning of one. So
You know, if there's anything I would echo is that we need to look out in the future, and that fact, we had this discussion last session, I think it got twisted a little bit over the kicker argument, but the fundamental policy still is begging, and I suggest somehow that we address that. Thank you.
Mr. Chairco, just to get out of it, one we remain at your call if you want any of that further discussion. We will obviously be at your second call. If there's one, I thought there was just a wonderful document in here. It's called The Anatomy of an Upgrade, and it's developed by Standard & Poor's, one of the primary rating agencies that looks at the state of Oregon. If you look at that, it says 10, under the bold, and it says 10 ways to improve your bond rating. You notice the number one, the first thing it says to do, if you want to improve your bond rating, is to develop or to enhance your budget stabilization fund. It is truly the most important thing to the rating agency. It's critical, and we will work with the committee and the chair to advance that.
Thank you very much, Ron. All right, we're going to close the public hearing on HCR 55 and HCR 60 and open a public hearing on HB 3400. Representative
Beck. How is this our little bill?
I believe you have some interest in this little bill.
Okay.
Would you please give us an overview, would you please, Mr. Moore?
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 3400 requires states to provide closed caption for broadcasting of public proceedings. Closed caption is one of the vehicles that would increase the reach of government programming throughout the country. The FCC has ruled that channels with a budget of less than 2 million are exempt from the closed captioning requirement. The law requires reasonable accommodations to be made for those citizens in this type of service. Also in your packet is a letter from one of the community television stations.
Thank you very much. Representative Beck, step on up, and is anybody here to testify in any of our sign-up? Yeah, we have a sign-up sheet here.
Okay. Yeah, I really don't have much to say about the bill. This was brought to me by some constituents and people in my community. I didn't realize we were going to be all set up today for this. It's exciting to walk in and see it in action, and I think there are probably some funding impediments or hurdles, so we'd say impediments, but funding hurdles to this whole concept, but we wanted to get this idea on the table for closed captioning and public hearings like this, and I look forward to hearing the discussion from people here to testify.
All righty. Thank you very much. We have Carolyn Gaisley. Yes, yeah, please.
It is. Look, Mr. Chair. All righty.
Well,
appreciate that, in Elgin.
Sure. And in Northeast Portland, and in Southwest Portland.
Okie doke.
Please proceed. Introduce yourself to the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. My name is Carolyn Gaisley, and I'm the general manager of LNS Captioning, a small business located in Portland. The objective of the legislation, as has already been described, is to provide access to meetings and proceedings of the legislature, its committees, and other meetings of governing bodies, of public bodies, which are broadcast throughout the state. Right now, the technology that's used is television. That is the tool that we use for helping people understand what's going on in their government. Live real-time closed captioning is a tool that I believe will meet that goal and make broadcasts accessible to the largest possible number of people, primarily people who are affected by hearing loss. 10% of the public is affected by some level of hearing loss, and captioning of important government meetings and the proceedings of the legislature is really necessary to help people who have hearing loss participate fully in the responsibilities of citizenship. As people continue to live longer and the population of older people especially continues to grow and the population of our state continues to grow, this kind of a tool will become more and more important for keeping people in touch with what their government is doing on their behalf. It will help people be better informed, it will help them follow issues that they're interested in, and it will help them participate in discussions as they choose. To be effective, access must be consistent and ongoing. To benefit people who need it, access has to be publicized, it has to be consistently available, and it has to be something that can be counted on, planned on. Those of us who don't suffer hearing loss take for granted how easily we have it to be able to attend, participate, and access information without making a lot of special requests, setting up a lot of special accommodations, and this is something that should be available to the broader population, not just those of us who happen to have stellar hearing. Without regular access and without well-publicized access, people who don't hear well get a real message, and that is that your participation really doesn't matter that much. And as that group of people grows, it will be more than 10% not too long from now, because the population is aging and people are living longer, hearing loss from things like loud music and other kinds of activities that we engage in fairly regularly in our culture right now is going to inevitably grow that group of people. The service must be planned and budgeted or it won't happen. This is something that from my chair at LMS Captioning I see regularly, and that is that there are many, many times when people want access to an event or to some kind of proceeding, a government proceeding, for example, where a request is made and then it's turned down because no money has been budgeted for this service and no planning has been done to provide it. It's kind of a chicken and egg thing where they won't plan and, you know, we can't plan and budget unless it's requested, and once we've requested it, it's usually not the right time to get in the plan and make it into the budget. So I'm asking for some wisdom and forethought be put into this that we can meet the needs of people in our community. It needs to be made a priority. Without that prioritization, it doesn't happen either. It's very, it's one of those things that's very easy to overlook in the kind of the day-to-day getting things done and moving around. It's not, and above all, it's not a casual or an occasional need. If you can't hear every day of your life, it's not going to help you if they have some government legislature on Tuesdays and Fridays every other month when the sun's shining and, you know, and people feel like you just can't count on it. You won't take advantage of it. No restaurant would be able to be in business on that basis. So it's not something that should be done on an as requested basis. That should be planned for and done in some kind of consistent, methodical, ongoing manner. Captioning provides broad access. It's a tool that can help more than just people who have hearing loss, but also people for whom English is a second language. It enhances their ability to comprehend what is going on above what they get from just the verbal, being able to hear verbally. So the combination of seeing the words and hearing the words, it results in much better comprehension for everyone. Late deafened and hard of hearing people often don't learn sign language, so the captioning is more inclusive of all people with hearing loss. They're both valuable tools, but captioning reaches out to mass audiences a little bit better. And captions can be used on television as well as on the internet if there should be a choice made to feature on a website someplace the proceedings of a particular committee or the legislature. That kind of text streaming should be done on the internet as well. The caption files can also be used to provide an electronic reference for officials and as staff members as reference. Finally, to address costs, it doesn't come without costs. It's a specialized service that requires highly skilled people who know how to use the equipment, who have developed skills to be able to do it real time, which is quite a bit different than straight court reporting, which allows you the opportunity to go back and fix your errors and things like that. It needs to have a higher level of quality in order to really provide access, otherwise you end up with junk and you can't really understand what's going on. If there's tons and tons of mistranslated words or errors in the action. The cost to do this for just the legislature alone is $52,000, and there's a sheet of assumptions and budget numbers. So that assumes 10 hours per week, 26 weeks, that's 260 hours, so $52,000. To also add the impact of the county government, at least the ones that already do broadcast, that's, and the video and online services, that's an additional $195,000. Thanks very much for the opportunity to present this concern and recommend solutions. I look forward to further comments from people, and I can answer questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Carol and Gaysen?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for coming today. I'll now call Alan Bishon.
Mr. Brading's on the also.
Certainly.
We're asking you the same thing in our respective communities.
Okay.
I have prepared some remarks. I did them this morning. I don't know if I have enough copies. So.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is, thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Alan Bishon. I'm director of Capital Community Television here in Salem, and we provide three non-commercial public educational and governmental access channels on the local cable system. And so what I'm providing you here, I want to let you know that we know that some communities, unfortunately, don't have community TV. So I'm just giving the thumbnail sketch of what we do, local government meetings, activities with local schools, local nonprofit organizations. Regarding government meetings, just to give you a thumbnail sketch of what we do yesterday, we did live coverage of the Salem City Council, which started at 6:30 and unfortunately went almost until midnight. Tonight we'll do the Salem Kaiser School Board, which will start at 6 and hopefully will end significantly before midnight. Tomorrow morning, I'm staff on duty for Marion County Commission. It will start at 9:30, and there have been very brief meetings with the new commission, but it will probably go until noon. And next Monday, we'll do the Kaiser City Council, which will start at 7 o'clock and probably go until 9 or 10. I should mention that we're very much in concert. I agree with everything Carolyn Gaisley said. I agree with everything, every comment. We're very much in concert with the idea of providing this information to a broader audience. That's the whole reason we exist. I mean, a major portion of our mission is to see that more people are involved with information, get involved with decisions, and we think our communities are better and more people take a stake in those decisions made when involved. We have one concern and one concern only, and that's the funding. When we do a government meeting, I should describe what it's like. Tomorrow morning, I'll drive up the truck and five volunteers will help me. Our direct cost on that government meeting will be pretty low. Cost is always an object to the nonprofit organizations that do the work that we do. I've got to say once again that we're very much in concert with this idea. My mom has significant hearing loss, and on Saturday I had my first hearing test in which I was diagnosed with a loss of some frequency in my left ear. The issue gets to be, will there be adequate funding built in that's secure? Because once the expectation is created in the community, people are going to want to see it continue, and rightfully so. We're a little bit concerned that this relies on state funding at a time when we watch what you do, and we know that you're pressed to fund many of your services. We also think that the estimates that have been given are significantly underestimate the amount of government meetings televised around the state. Just using Carolyn's figure of $195,000 just given, we televise about 500 hours of government meetings alone in Salem. And that would come to a figure quoted as $200 an hour to $100,000.
There are three organizations in Portland that televise more than we do. So just for four community TV organizations, and I'll be real candid, those are the four biggest ones in the state, we figure that you're looking at close to $500,000 a year to fund closed captioning. And I don't know if a fiscal impact study has been done, but I would just ask to be, our message, primary message, is to be very thoughtful about gathering enough information to know those costs and to know that they're going to be funded.
We do have a fiscal and on this, and it says anywhere from $212,500 for 6 months legislative session for in-house services to $1.175 million for contracted services. What I would like to know is voice recognition technology, computer-based voice recognition technology, what kind of gains are being made there that would help lower the cost of implementing such a proposal?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I spoke with the one community TV organization which has done closed captioning in the state, and that's Portland Cable Access. They've done it on a contract basis. And I talked with their engineer who used to work for us, and he's one really sharp guy. And he says, 10 years away, potentially 10 years away. Right now, voice recognition requires slow, distinct speech. And I don't know about your government meetings, but a lot of our government meetings, slow and distinct does not describe the type of speech that you often see. It would be great if voice recognition were further along, because I could improve my computer skills to get away from my keyboard. I just want to let you know that I guess the next thing, comment that I should make is that community television budgets are limited. We would have to look at costs in three areas, not only the operational costs, which I think are the most dramatic, but we would have to look at a number of equipment systems. A lot of our equipment is somewhat old, and we're not like NBC, CBS, and ABC that probably change their equipment very frequently. We have a lot of equipment that's 9 years old in place, and that's because we're a nine-year-old organization. If we were older, we'd have older equipment. We're aware, and having talked with TJ beforehand, and this was really good for us to be able to talk with an ADA expert, because once again, we're very much in concert with what's going on. You know, the commercial networks are funded by the federal government. Our concern is that the state budget getting tight, that the onus might go back to local governments. And I have to say that not only would this be more than one quarter of our budget, which would be devastating to us, but if the local governments were asked to fund this, we're funded from 40% of the cable television franchise fees they collect. Given the tightness of their budget, I don't see any expansion. I think they would say 40% is all we can do. You have to handle it from here. And an unintended consequence could be that we would either have to stop televising government meetings or cut back our operation, which in effect would also cut back the number we could televise. Mr. Vice Chair and committee members, thank you for the time.
Mr. Brady, I'm actually here in case folks have kind of Portland-oriented questions. I just do want to observe that when Carolyn Gaisley was speaking, I thought that it was like the mission of my organization, and I'm the chair of our national organization board, and it was like our mission sitting here talking about including people in the process, and we would very much like for this to happen. We have cost concerns. It's really very simple.
If you use your example, I'm fairly familiar with some of the cable access operations in the metropolitan area. TVCA probably broadcasts somewhere in the neighborhood of 4 to 5 governmental entities.
That's correct. That's correct.
Portland cable access, probably 2 to 3. And
Well, I did a little research, and each one of the organizations, Multnomah Community Television, Tualatin Valley, and Portland Cable Access, cablecast somewhere in the range of 50 hours of government programming a month. So in the Portland metropolitan area, for those three facilities, we're talking over 150 hours every month, and that doesn't include some other programming that's done down in Clackamas County primarily by volunteers.
As I know, in my area, Lake Oswego, Tiger, Tualatin, and Wilsonville are all cablecast.
Right, right.
And West Bend is probably cablecast, and the other smaller system that's south of there.
Mm-hmm.
Any vast committee that's here, I have to really turn my head.
Sorry to drive you.
Any questions?
you just understand what you're saying, Mr. Chair.
Well, okay.
I guess, Chair, if we found the money, you guys don't object.
No, we'd love it.
I think
it would be great.
We'd have a problem. We can't. I'm not sure we can impose this on local government under, was it Measure 30? What's our local mandate?
Measure 30.
So we couldn't pass this and meet the Measure 30 requirement. We have to provide money. I don't think the bill as it's written would probably need to be changed. I don't know why. I just thought this would be a way to mean, have a way to mean referral on it. I don't see that, but I don't think we can just pass this and meet Measure 30 requirements. Hopefully we can find the money. I think the goal would be to get you together with Carolyn and other advocates and start building a coalition to fund this, somewhere down the road, to work with the cable people, figure out a way to fund these sort of services.
Mr. Vice Chair and Representative Beck, I really appreciate that, and as long as we see this as a state-level funding issue, I think we have an opportunity to succeed. If it ever becomes a local issue, I believe it's destined to fail.
Still, the funding, listen, you just talk usually about the money.
That's right.
Yeah, well, there's no reason the state couldn't come up with a way to help fund this through grants to local communities. If we wanted to, or provide those communities, you can make it optional, but provide them with their funding mechanism to use. Some kind of tax authority they don't have today, I don't know. But maybe we need to advocate. We need to figure out how to advocate for the money instead of worrying about, obviously worried about there not being money, but I'd like to see a more proactive approach to help find the money, too.
Mr. Vice Chair and Representative Beck, I appreciate your interest in that way. A local tax in Salem has not passed since the supermajority requirement and is not expected to pass of any kind. So once again, if we're looking at a statewide level and coalition working to find statewide funding, I think we would all be glad to work in that coalition.
Well, I'm not sure this. I think the supermajority only applies to property tax. Right? That's correct, Richard?
Yeah, the supermajority requirement only applies to
property tax revenue. So I don't know if that's relevant. A city government can impose, I assume, has the authority to impose taxes on cable.
No.
They do not.
Okay, well, then that would not require supermajority to be able to impose something on the cable companies. You have to work with them. They'll fight it. But.
Cable companies are, Mr. Vice Chair and Representative Beck, cable companies right now, federal law determines how much cable companies' compensation can be required, and they're paying the maximum.
Okay. So it's all federal. Not realm of law. I'm familiar with.
We've had to deal with it.
Yeah.
But to repeat the further or the previous comment, we would be glad to work in such a coalition if we're talking statewide arena. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Davis from the Oregon Disabilities Commission. Please proceed.
For the record, my name is T.J. Davis. I am the program director of the state's Deaf and Hard of Hearing Access Program and the Oregon Disabilities Commission ADA Policy Advisor. Vice Chair and members of the committee, I'll keep my comments brief since in the interest of time. Basically, I've come to talk about two points. One is the federal requirements already in place on public entities to provide access to this type of programming anyway. Under the Americans with Disabilities Act, in Title II, public entities are required to ensure that communications contained within all of their services, benefits, activities
be accessible to persons with disabilities and specifically accessible to people who are deaf and hard of hearing. The obvious intent of that was to ensure that citizens who are deaf and hard of hearing had equal participation and equal access into the activities of their government. So the federal requirements are already there on the public entities. What the intent of this bill is to provide some mechanism to make that compliance happen. On the other side of it, as a person who's hard of hearing myself, I depend on captioning in a lot of settings. I use real-time captioning in many meetings myself. There's 350,000 Oregonians who are deaf or hard of hearing, and that's a significant number of people, particularly when you also include, as Carolyn mentioned earlier, the persons who have English as a second language and children who are learning to read now, since most TVs have built-in captioning decoders and most national programming is already captioned. Captioning is becoming an important tool in reading programs and in English as a second language programs because it provides a printed out text display of what's being said. On the other side of this, the cost issue, I did not understand the bill to make every single one of them do it. I think that that was going to be pursuant to the rules that DAS would adopt to determine how and when and where. And I believe that most of the people, at least the people who are advocating it, and myself included, feel that it would be best to be used in certain situations, in certain types of meetings, not every meeting. Obviously, there may be some interest in Fort Rock's water sewer meeting, but chances are they'd be used in more general settings of people that we would definitely see that there'd be a benefit there. How and when and where I think would be left to the rules process, and I would encourage that obviously our agency be involved in that, as the television producers out there be involved with DAS in developing those rules to address when and where. And I, from my understanding, did not feel that it was intended to include every possible thing that was being captioned. Perhaps maybe for the legislative session in their televised closed circuit and cable access services. But in general, I think that some of those concerns obviously would be for ways and means on the cost end of it, but I don't feel that it would cover or intend to cover every type of service. And to be honest, I don't think we have the capabilities provider-wise to even do that at this point in this state. And so those are my comments.
Any questions for the Representative Edwards?
Actually, this is maybe a question to the sponsor, Representative Beck. You know, we just got a notice that our proceedings are going to go on the net. Do you know, is the technology there to put closed caption on the Internet?
I'd have to defer to Carolyn. I believe there is. It's in the developmental stages, but it has been used already. Obviously, there would be some coordination requirements for whomever is doing that to ensure that that happens.
That would seem like a reasonable thing to do if we act on this, to ensure that it's accessible outside of the building as well.
Right. Any additional questions? Thank you, Mr. Davis. Go on to our final person, Mr. Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ray Lewis. I'm Director of Video and Online Services, which is a unit of the Information Resource Management Division of the Department of Administrative Services. Video and Online Services, which was previously called Oregon EdNet, which may help the context for some of you, has had considerable experience with closed captioning over the years. And since many of the broadcasts on our video network have been closed captioned, and so we're familiar with their technology and have worked closely with people who've been providing that. We view the objectives of the both of the bills, that, although there's only, we're only talking about the HB 3400 here, we view the goals of both of these are very worthwhile, but we do suggest that there's a need for some additional qualifying language to ensure effective management and funding of closed captioning in Oregon. The additional language should help clarify such questions as what body would administer the funds, what criteria would be used to dispense funds if the demand for closed captioning turns out to be greater than the amount of money appropriated. Would this bill require local or state government entities to videotape or video programs that they previously were not planning on videoing in order to provide the access to hearing-impaired citizens? And also, is this intended as a pilot project or as a long-term as a long-term program to which the state would be committed? I think those are some of the kinds of questions that if the bill included language that was a little bit more specific, it would be easier to judge whether or not it would actually work in practice. I think we can all agree that it's a very worthwhile idea, but we do realize that there are some potential funding impacts here on public entities that we all need to pay attention to.
Any questions?
Sharon, I assume you're willing to work with the advocates to come up with some language if we want to bring this back. We can get something crafted here.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Beck, we'd be happy to work with a group of people who are trying to address these problems. I think it's very clear that there's going to be not only are more events in our society being videoed or being put over the internet, but there's going to be more and more demand for that, and we need to find ways to accommodate a wider range of citizens getting access to that.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on House Bill 3400? Hearing none, the hearing is closed for House Bill 3400. We'll move on to House Bill 3174. I'll open the hearing. Committee Administrator, give an explanation.
Mr. Vice Chair and Committee Members, House Bill 3174 eliminates the authority of state agencies to file proposed legislative measures except through a member of committee or legislature. Current statute permits the state agencies to introduce legislation directly to the Assembly. Mr. Vice Chair, some past legislation that was done in the Senate Bill 1997, SB 45. To keep the spirit of the three branches of government, this bill defines the line of authority for introduction of legislation by the Assembly itself, the governor, or through citizen initiative and referendum process. There are those who believe that the government grows at a startling pace. Further, those believe the extension of state agencies have added layer upon layer of regulatory complexity to the burdens of those who must survive in the private sector. They hire staff, they lobby, and they propose various legislation. Once the legislature enacts the programs to lobby for the money to fund these programs, are a public expense, and there's some concerns regarding the spiral effect of funding.
This is Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Representative from House District 15 in Southeast Portland. I don't know if I'll address all of the aspects that staff just outlined there regarding the interpretation of this bill. Maybe I want to address one part of it, and that is I think it's a balance of powers or a separation of powers issue. It's a small bill, but I think it's meaningful. What we're looking at doing is prohibiting state agencies from basically introducing legislation, which I believe is in the purview of the legislative branch. And when you look around the country, a majority of states don't allow any agency to file legislation. I think that's telling, and I think it's when I talk to some folks about why we allow that to happen, it's basically a process issue to try to get ideas introduced early on in the session. I think with term limits and how we conduct our business, I think this issue becomes even more compelling, and that is how do we make sure there's a balance of power here, that legislation is, again, the purview of the legislature. And I think it's a small change in that by requiring a agency, in my mind, to come through a legislator you are asking us as an individual or as a committee for buy-in on that concept. I think as you look at this session, there's been hundreds of bills introduced, and I've asked DAF, and I believe they're going to testify on this bill, to give a precise number of bills that have been pre-session filed. I don't know what that count is exactly, but I had staff to look, and currently at least rough estimates show a few hundreds of bills have been pre-session filed just for this session alone. Again, I'm really motivated by an issue of separation of powers more than anything, and I kind of overlay that again on what I believe term limits is creating, and that is the ability for us to serve the people as best as possible. And again, the concept of introducing legislation and actually having it passed is our purview, I believe, not the executive branch. And so I think this is, again, a small change, but I think a significant change in how we conduct our business here. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Edwards. I couldn't agree more. I think it is important that we keep some separation there, and that it is more appropriate for either the governor or legislators to be introducing measures than have agencies introducing measures. So, that's indicated by my name there beside yours on top of the bill. Any questions from the committee, Representative Williams?
Representative Edwards, you know, it just got, and maybe you said this whispering the representative back. How many bills this session were pre-session filed by state agents?
I don't have that exact number. I actually sent a letter to DAF to ask them to give us that number.
I noticed that legislative council, Mr. Chamoff, is in the room with us. Is that a number you might know off the top of your head, council? Okay. Just checking. But there is someone that does have that number who's not in your head, so maybe we'll get an opportunity to hear from her.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
As was stated earlier, I believe there is somebody from DAF to maybe
address that.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
All righty. Well, let's bring up Susan Klosterman from DAF. Thank you, Representative Edwards.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Susan Klosterman. I'm Assistant Director for Communications with the Department of Administrative Services. And I am not aware of a letter being received asking for information on the number of bills, and I do apologize if it's been very late. But I do have that number. We have pre-session filed 370 substantive bills roughly this session, and the same amount last session. Substantive bills, I'm not including the appropriation or budget bills that are filed and go directly to Ways and Means. I wanted to just bring briefly, in respect for the hour of the day, some information to the committee about the process and the bills that the agencies pre-session file. All of the bills for agencies other than the elected offices, the governor's office does, and all the other agencies send their legislative proposals to the Department of Administrative Services. This process starts almost a year before the legislative session. Agencies are working with their stakeholders, their customers, other state agencies and local governments to get information and gather ideas and ensure that what they put forward has some input and consensus. And one of the points I really want to make to the committee is that we do have a review process. Agencies submit their concepts to DAF. Those concepts are reviewed by their budget analysts in the Budget and Measurement Division, and they're also reviewed by the governor's policy advisor before they're sent to Legislative Council for drafting. Once those bills have been drafted, they come back to the Department of Administrative Services, and they're again reviewed in their final form by the budget analyst and also by the governor's policy advisor before their pre-session filed. And that review ensures that the measure is consistent with the governor's policies and the governor's budget, also that the administrative mechanisms are in place to make sure that it has the accounts, if it's a finance bill, for example, but that it works administratively within state government. And also we look among the state agencies to make sure that they're consistent and that there aren't two bills filed on the same subject for one agency and that they work well together. Agencies file bills for a number of different reasons. In many cases, they're complying with changing federal law or federal programs. They are also working from interim committee information, directions from prior legislature, and submitting legislation or measures for consideration by the legislature. They're also raising policy issues for discussion. They may be things that the agency just thinks needs a fair discussion and some attention by the legislature. They also submit bills that are necessary to support the governor's budget. Of the 300, there are about 70 substantive bills that do that. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'll conclude just by saying that if there are issues about the bills being filed by agencies, we would welcome a chance to work with you to address those issues. Any questions?
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Devers?
I apologize. I was talking about that. Could you, once again, have how many bills were in session?
About 370 in the same last session. About 70 of those are necessary to support the governor's budget. They're substantive bills, but necessary for that purpose. And I think, assuming there are about 3,000 measures filed each session, that's about 12% of the total. And someone looked back to see last session how many of those bills passed, and there were 65% of the agency bills passed, for your information.
Yes,
that's better than a minority member.
You're better than a majority member.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, it's because you're so necessary.
Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Klossman, I guess I'd be interested in seeing, if it's available, some breakdown of the agencies that are submitting the bills. And I'll give you an example. I mean, we've had a number of extremely important bills submitted by the Support Enforcement Division and the Civil Judiciary Committee to bring them into compliance with federal law on the support enforcement work. Very technical stuff, and the agency did an admirable job in putting the bills together. So, you know, I can think of probably, you know, 10 or 15 bills just off the top of my head that came into the Civil Judiciary Committee that way. But I think, at least for me, it would be instructive to get an idea of which agencies are submitting the bills, and some, you know, maybe even just a little shorthand description or something like that that you could provide to the committee might be helpful.
We do have that information.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Warren, thank you. And I don't believe personally that it would be a burdensome initial additional step for the agencies to have to go to a member of the legislature or the governor to get their bills filed. I think it would be an appropriate step to require that you go ahead and do that.
Mr. Chairman, the governor's office is very much involved in the process now, so it may not be. We could probably file them with the governor's authority and then at times with the legislative authority.
All righty. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Mr. DiLorenzo. Today.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm John DiLorenzo. I'm an attorney from Portland, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Litigation Reform Coalition. During the 1997 session, my client had backed a very similar piece of legislation. I have brought along with me House Bill 3174, which you're hearing, and also House Bill 2788, which I believe has been introduced by the chair in comparison. And I'd like to just speak a little bit about both bills and the reason why my organization originally supported this bill and why I feel either version is a good idea. 3174, introduced by primarily by Representative Edwards and Simmons, eliminates the ability for state agencies to pre-session file legislation. 2788 eliminates the authority of state agencies, DAS, and the governor to pre-session file legislation, and that's the major difference between the two. I'd like to point out that there is not only a statutory scheme that allows agencies and the governor to pre-session file bills, you also have a House rule that specifically allows agencies and the governor to pre-session to pre-session file bills, as does the Senate. It has its own Senate rule that permits that. These bills address the statutory sessions that permit agencies, the governor, and DAS to pre-session file bills. I have always had Article 3 concerns about the statutes that permit agencies to pre-session file bills. As you know, Article 3 of the Constitution refers to the separation of powers, and it provides for clear separation of the legislative, executive, and judicial branches. There have been many cases in which legislation that has provided that the executive branch and the legislative branch commingle their functions in order to accomplish something. There have been many cases in which courts have struck down that type of legislation. Years ago, when the Capitol Mall was built, there was a Capitol Mall Commission that consisted of members of the executive branch and members of the legislative branch, and that statutory scheme was declared unconstitutional. As recently as a few years ago, the Oregon Supreme Court declared a statutory scheme which allowed the Environmental Quality Commission to approve the level of out-of-state waste fees in concert with the Ways and Means Committee or the Legislative Emergency Board. That type of a statutory scheme was unconstitutional. Although no one has ever raised it, I have always wondered whether bills that were introduced under the statute by agencies would suffer a similar affliction, mostly because I can think of no activity that is more legislative in character than filing a bill. I can't think of anything that a legislator does other than voting on bills that is truly more legislative in character. Now, it is one thing for an agency, the governor, or a lobbyist or a member of the citizenry to approach a legislator and ask for permission to file a bill. It's another thing for a committee to file a bill, but it's wholly another thing for an agency to have statutory authority to act as a legislator. And so this has always been a concern of mine, although I must admit that I am aware of no one who has ever had occasion to raise the concern. No one has wanted to do it because it would cut both ways, because there are many bills that have been agency bills in the past that would advantage and disadvantage certain constituencies, and so no one has ever done it. I guess, though, there are some practical concerns, too, as to why you should take one of the two approaches in these two bills. First, the question is as to use of legislative council's time and how it is allocated. Should legislative council's time be allocated primarily to working on agency bill requests when there are members who have bills whose legislation has not yet been acted on? Secondly, I'm concerned that the present system does not require the governor to take responsibility for agency bills. There are many agency bills which are introduced for the purpose of testing the waters or introducing a subject for discussion. Well, I don't see the governor's name on those bills. The Constitution requires the governor to recommend legislation to the legislature, not agencies. I think Representative Edwards' bill would be a great step in that direction, because it would, in essence, if there was to be pre-session filing at all, require it to be done through the governor's office. And the governor would, in fact, have to take responsibility for every single proposal that was introduced by an agency. Third, I am concerned about the flurry of bills which appear in the bill packets before any bills submitted by members are ever printed. And fourth, it is evident to me that there is no wonder as to why, then, in that case, your committees have no choice but to advance the consideration of the agendas of state agencies before it considers your agenda, because your bills just aren't printed yet. So it seems to me, for those practical reasons, requiring agencies to come to legislators or to come to legislative committees and to request bill introduction appears to be a good policy. It eliminates the prospect of the Article 3 concerns, and it certainly puts agencies on the same in the same playing field as any other private party who must request permission of a legislator or committee before bills are introduced. So I think either one of these bills would be good policy. My own preference, of course, is House Bill 2788. I understand, though, Representative Edwards' rationale in preparing 3174, and it is attractive to require all agency proposals to, in essence, be funneled to the governor, who ultimately should be taking responsibility for them anyway. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you, and if you have any questions, I'd be pleased to answer them.
Indeed. Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, have you looked at any other states? Are there any other states that have a system like ours that allows agencies to file bills in advance of a legislative session? Have you done any of that analysis?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Williams, I have not done that analysis, although I must confess that about a year and a half ago, when I was in Washington, D.C., and I was talking to some congressional staff, I did mention this practice, and of course the congressional staff were absolutely shocked that an agency would have the power to introduce a bill. You know, that's something that in Congress, anyway, members are extremely protective of. And of course, there are fewer bills maybe introduced in Congress than there are in the Oregon legislature, but they were absolutely shocked that an agency could act as a legislator, at least in that capacity.
Representative Madden.
Thank you. I must admit that when I first looked at this bill, I thought, what the heck is this for? And in fact, I have to tell you that until I heard your testimony, it just seemed to me that this is just off the wall. But on reflection, you're saying...
Top liver.
I'm sorry to hear Representative Edwards' testimony.
I was persuaded by Representative Edwards' testimony.
But then, on reflection, your point about Article 3 and the filtering process and the authority to file a bill, there is a point there that any agency ought to be able to convince a legislative committee, an interim committee, that the bill is worth proceeding with, and there could be a filter there that prevents us from printing bills that haven't got a prayer, and if you can't find at least a returning member or a member-elect to adopt the bill as via sponsorship, or you can't get an interim committee to submit the bill, and maybe the bill is already in trouble, and you save some of the process. I'd be curious as to what's been done in other states, because that just gives us an idea for what the process is. Some of us, like Topsy, the process just grew, and some of us just saw it there and assumed, well, that's the way it's done. But it doesn't hurt every once in a while to take a step back, take a deep breath, and say, why are we doing it this way? And I'm not convinced pro or con, but I recognize now that it's a legitimate question in terms of the prerogatives of the legislative assembly as opposed to the executive branch.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, I might just also comment that I have not done much research in the area, but I heard basically that one of the reasons for adopting this rule to begin with years ago was that committees didn't have enough to do when the legislature first convened. And so this was a way of filling the pipeline so that at least on day one, legislative committees would have bills to consider. That is certainly no longer the case today. There is certainly no longer the need to advance an agency agenda because there just aren't any bills that have been written yet or are ready to be written yet by members. So. But from what I have been able to tell, there was an efficiency concern which gave rise to the original legislation. But it seems to me that efficiency concern is no longer here, and even if it existed, it should certainly take second place to the Article 3 and the other concerns which you have voiced.
Mr. Chair, yes, if I could add on to that point, that my research also suggested that that's the rationale for why we allow pre-session filing. That it was an issue of workload more than anything.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I made a remark to Reverend Beck, who's not here right now, which is going on there, that what's also interesting is the bills that don't get through the executive branch filtration process and from time to time I make a point of inquiring of certain agencies whose operations interest me. Can you tell me about the proposed legislation that never made it? Because maybe there's something there that I would like to play with and would like to file, and from time to time I do find those things, and it sort of, on the triage system of things of priority for the executive branch, it didn't make it. But on my triage system, it was a worthwhile endeavor, and then go ahead and file the bill and get to the baseline. It's interesting that we have a system where all those ideas are being bounced off legislators. There might be an opportunity then to get further ideas developed that otherwise don't reach it.
Interesting food for thought. Any further questions from the committee? Hearing none, we will close the public hearing on 3174.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. DiLorenzo. And we have four of the bills for us today that I'm just going to do a quick cap open and close on, and we'll be done. If we do have a witness for 2980, that's an buyer's bill. And the intent is to hang on to the relating clause for future work. So we're just going to quickly open a public hearing on House Bill 2911 and close the public hearing on House Bill 2911. And we're going to go down to House Bill 3146 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3146 and close the public hearing on 3146. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2980. And close the public hearing on House Bill 2980, and we're going to go on over it today.
Oh, yeah.
And we're going to open the public hearing on House Bill 3537, and close the public hearing on House Bill 3537. And if you know other business for the committee, we are adjourned.